welcome to the 49th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as Monty Panesar celebrates England retaining the Ashes in his own rather unique way, welcome to the podcast that's offering to pay his fine.
It's brilliant, isn't it? The Ashes used to be played out on the green fields of Lords or the Oval, and now it's more likely all the action happens in a bar deep in London somewhere.
Well, it's interesting, but by the time you've had David Warner at his rather interesting incident, and now you've got
in Birmingham, wasn't it?
Warner in Birmingham, and I think Panesar in Brighton, actually. And it says, sadly, it does rather say something about the series, that Monty Panesar's extracurricular toilet-based activities have been dominating the front pages over the Ashes, which it does
but
say
actually,
something.
But actually, it's been quite fun, and actually, David Warner's exploit particularly kind of added a bit of spice to the whole thing, wasn't it? I mean, it certainly added when in the last test he came out and Joe Root obviously caught him. It added that wonderful little subplot.
I just don't listen to post-match player interviews anymore. They're very, very tedious, which is why I found myself very surprised to be enjoying and listening to David Warner's interview after his day at Old Trafford. He came out with what will probably be the line of the summer, hooked another one to Rooty. But aside from the comedy...
That was delivered impeccably, by the way.
Was it?
With all the comic timing.
Really? Thanks very much. But
it's pity you don't have the facial hair to match.
Aside from the fact that he's, you know, it was a funny line, it was a good line, it was just a very, very honest interview. And it made you think that actually, it made you realise we go through so many of these anodyne, media-trained player interviews, that actually having a player just being very honest and, you know, saying things like, yeah, the England crowd got on my back, I had to deal with it, you know, he came across very well for it.
Particularly when you compare it to someone like Alistair Cook, who I was watching the other day. And he really does come out with an awful lot of platitudes, actually.
They've just been so well trained and they've just been so worn down by it.
They have. So while you've been watching player interviews, I have been watching Sky Sports Ashes, the Sky Sports cricket dedicated channel. It has some 20 games. It also obviously has some Ashes matches on it, but it also has some replays of some old matches, and it's been brilliant. I mean, it's also been awful because for a cricket loving procrastinator, it means that you spend every evening watching cricket. But it's been really interesting getting home, and you know, you switch it on, and there is. I was watching the other night the second test in 2006. As you observed, 2006, you have to be pretty brave as an England fan to watch that.
I guess what's interesting is the difference between sitting down and deciding, "Ooh, I'll go and get the 2005 DVD," and accidentally finding yourself watching.
Exactly. The last day was on there, and actually, it provides a really interesting counterpoint to what's going on at the moment, because you have a fair few players who are still out there, and you look back and you kind of see actually Giles bowling, and it brings back all those feelings that we had in the early 2000s, mostly a pain and fear.
It's a really interesting point though, because as cricket fans, we're too good at just making ourselves watch those great days again and again. Well, actually, if you want to get the full memory, you really have to go back to those bad days as well as those good days. And on the subject of bad days, a beautiful segue. Zimbabwe had, they had five very, very bad days against India. I found this series really difficult because I'm a very passionate advocate of small sides getting their chance against the big sides. I feel like it doesn't happen enough, and I feel like it's a key component of their development. But this showed the problem of those contests because it was so one-sided, and cricket without a contest doesn't do the game any favours. I should say, I think India really deserved to be commended for going out there, playing not just a token ODI, but playing five ODIs, taking a team that, with the odd fringe player aside, was actually, you know, there was Virat Kohli, there was Suresh Raina, Amit Mishra, there were lots of good players.
Do you think that's
there
to be commended, though? Because actually, I think there's an argument for them taking over a weaker side and really creating a contest and testing out some new players. Absolutely, I agree with you that there's sometimes it's slightly patronising to take out a B side. But in this case, I mean, no one benefits, surely, from
winning 5-0. I'm genuinely undecided on this. Did Zimbabwe get something out of it or not by being creamed? I'm undecided. One very interesting thing to note from the final ODI at Bulawayo: after the game, Zimbabwean players rushed to the Indian dressing room, according to their coach, apparently just wanting to grill them, ask them questions, quiz them. And I thought, that's promising. You know, if you're a coach of a young side, you see them quizzing, you know, these talented cricketers, that's promising. But I hope Zimbabwe got something out of it. And you've been depressed by, the Australian selection policy, which is something of a chaotic beast. I mean, even calling it a policy seems a bit of a stretch. But
yeah, I mean, the idea of selection policy is a kind of an elusive one. But yeah, there are two players who've been puzzling me over the course of this Ashes. For Australia, Shane Watson, and for England, Johnny Bairstow. Shane Watson, who anyone who has any passing interest in cricket whatsoever will be able to predict how he gets out. He will get to 30, and he will plant his front foot down the wicket, and he will be out LBW, and he will review it as well.
Yeah.
And it will be shown to be out every single time. And it just seems to me that it's kind of indicative of the slightly lacklustre approach of the Australians at the moment, that they frankly don't have the balls to say to him, this isn't good enough. I mean, in this match, it'll be interesting to see where he bats, actually. Whether they're going to put him back into the middle order now that Warner's back.
Seems to be, if he's a player of ability, which he obviously is, do you back him to solve it in the middle, or do you drop him?
It just can't be seen to be acceptable to be an opening batsman and to so consistently have failed for the same reason. Now, Johnny Bairstow is a completely different question, and I just have this odd thought. I don't think he's a test quality batsman. And he doesn't bowl at all.
Yeah.
He was a keeper for Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And he's not keeping for England. The only thing I can imagine that is that he's in there to take Pryor's place when
the one thing I would say about Johnny Bairstow is I think he has been extremely lucky. Like, you look at his record and you look at players who've been dropped for less, and you think, you do occasionally feel like there are certain players who just get the rub of the green in selection policy, and you feel like Bairstow's got that.
And I'm wondering why the selectors are sticking through him.
Is it this idea you just don't shuffle with a winning side? Is that part of it? They just don't want to.
Well, we'll see whether England keep on winning, won't we? From the archives, and this podcast has often been inspired by the Amber Liquid. In fact, we once had to record before 11 a.m. with the aid only of black coffee, and things went, well, pretty horribly wrong. And this episode, Andy's going to take us to a time when beer inspired cricketers too.
It's 1989, and Australia are flying out to the Ashes. They've been beaten in the two previous Ashes series, and they've just lost to the West Indies at home. And actually, much like the current Australia team, they're facing allegations of being the worst Australian side ever. But David Boone, that mustachioed beast of a man, didn't seem particularly bothered by things. He wasn't, in fact, focused at all on the little urn. He had in his sights a rather peculiar record. Australia's Rod Marsh had previously set a record for consuming 44 cans of beer on a single plane journey. Now, Rod Marsh's record, justifiably, had assumed a status of legend amongst Australian teams.
It's funny you should say legend, actually, because when you were first describing that situation, you know, the worst team of all time, mustachio genius, it sounded a bit like Beowulf.
Well, I'm creating a sort of epic story.
Yeah, it is epic. So here he was, his mind on the goal, on this target.
Quite, like any sportsman, clearly focused on the goal, clearly focused on setting a record that he would forever be remembered for. Boone, interestingly, has refused to ever confirm or deny his record attempt. When asked about it by journalists, he says, never talked about it, never will. So it's impossible to know the motive for his bold record attempt. I mean, I wonder perhaps to what extent it's boredom. I mean, it's a long flight to Australia.
How long is it? Sorry, a long flight to
England.
Talking to 12 hours?
Yeah. We're talking a long journey. Or perhaps, I've sometimes wondered whether maybe you have a team that are being treated miserably in the press. Maybe it was his way of livening things up. Maybe it was his way of sort of building a bit of team spirit. The other thing about Boone's quest to break this record of 44 cans of beer was that it actually came at a time when professionalism was really taking hold of cricket. And it was almost an act of rebellion against it. Australia was captained now by Alan Border. This is a guy, a hard-line captain, who had extremely demanding standards of his players. And with Bob Simpson as coach, Bob Simpson was a man who really brought fitness into Australian cricket.
This was the new regime. So in the mid-1980s, Australia had been, as you've referred to, had been completely thrashed.
Mm.
And this is when the Australian Cricket Academy, which is still going and still produces much of their best talent, had been started up. And this is when Australia, actually, it's kind of got ahead of the world in terms of setting up professionalism. And then we have this one rogue spirit.
And from the benefit of hindsight, you can see 89 is a time where really they established a dominance which was to last, you know, for decades.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it was that combination of Border's discipline, Simpson's emphasis on fitness. So Boone was very out of step with this. And kind of as a reflection of that, him and the couple of friends who accompanied him on his quest didn't do so just in the normal plane. They had to retreat to the galley almost to hide. Jeff Lawson, Australian bowler at the time, kept score of this record attempt.
I love the idea of taking the scorebook along and marking it down.
Well, I suppose for a record that was seen as this important and this kind of, I mean, you imagine Boone himself would not have been in condition to have kept a sort of independent chart on what he was drinking. But Lawson says something quite interesting in hindsight, where he said, I think the culture of the 70s changed through to the 80s. There weren't too many big drinkers in the team then. And the point about that being that, actually, I think if you'd done this 10 years earlier, there'd have been loads of Aussies joining in. But actually, yeah, Boone found himself very much a lone ranger.
So hang on, can we just clarify exactly how much
okay, so
he was drinking?
52 beers are the Australian version of a beer that's commonly known in Australia as a tinny. As a, 375 mil each. That's 19.5 litres or 34.3 pints.
So yeah, I mean, we were discussing earlier, you know, what a kind of average big night was.
We would say,
and
I
you
think,
were worried
I
about
think,
never
I
having
think,
reached
I
double
think,
figures.
I think 34.3 nights, it would be ludicrous to even frame it.
34.3 nights?
For 34.3 pints, it would be ludicrous to even see it in the realm of a big night. I mean, this is yeah, for most yeah. people, this is 10,
this is
20
this
big
is coma,
nights.
This is coma territory.
I enjoy the story of Dean Jones, who at this stage is a young Aussie prospect, and his dad had given him some good advice. He said, you know, sit next to David Boone, stay by him, because, you know, you can learn some advice about batting. Instead, Jones finds himself dragged into this epic quest and sees kind of a side of sport that he probably didn't expect.
And actually probably learns quite a lot from it as well.
Well, learned things that he, again, didn't expect to learn from it. The key detail, although we have no real detail on quite how the record was achieved or the drama behind it, but Boone broke the record. He got to 52 pints, so not just going past Rodney Marsh's record, but breaking it quite comfortably. He managed to walk from the plane without help, which is frankly quite staggering. There's a really nice story here where they had to go straight from the plane to a press conference, and the journalists became aware of what had taken place. And they all clubbed together and agreed not to ask Boone any questions, which I thought is quite indicative of a time when the relationship between journalists and players was good, you know. And
yeah,
I'm not saying it isn't now, but there wasn't an attempt to catch him out. There wasn't
to make a story, I suppose, which is probably what would have happened.
Oh,
nowadays.
Certainly now, you know, it would be. You know,
I mean, see Monty Panesar.
Well, quite. I enjoy the fact that Bob Simpson, despite his fanatical emphasis on fitness, the only reprimand he is supposed to have given to Boone after the incident was, I'm very disappointed with you. Which, for a professional sportsman who has just consumed close to his own body weight and alcohol, seems, frankly, rather lenient.
It sounds like a parent telling a five-year-old to go back to bed after they've kind of sneaked out.
And there's a vital postscript to all of this, which is that Boone went on to have a great series. He averaged 55 as Australia regained the Ashes. And this is kind of key, because had he gone and had a terrible series, you'd think, you know, what a useless drunk. But the point is, he wasn't just a heavy drinker, he was a brilliant sportsman. And I think cricket fans have always had a sympathy, more than a sympathy, an affection and a respect for those players who can balance hard playing with hard living.
We'll go on to talk about, we're reviewing a book on Howard Larwood later this episode, who was also a heavy drinker. And actually, I'm no real sportsman, obviously, but I personally find it hard to believe that cricketers need the kind of protein shake levels that, you know, say a rugby player or a football player needs. It's just not that kind of exertion, particularly if you're a batsman, for instance.
Well, that is a topic for a whole new debate.
It's certainly,
but I'm sure David Boone would agree. And I think part of it is the ability to empathise, because at the end of the day, whereas we can't relate to players with, frankly, almost, you know, the physique of a well-toned Jimmy Anderson. I'm not quite sure why I picked Jimmy Anderson, but, you know, very, you know,
secret like, crush coming
a man, a man who looks after himself. Whereas we can relate to someone who has a good time but happens to be very talented with it. To the review, and this episode we're looking at Duncan Hamilton's biography of Harold Larwood. It's the first biography of Larwood, and an attempt by this great writer Hamilton to try to get to grips with a vital figure in cricket history who's actually been much misunderstood.
The last book that we reviewed by Hamilton was The Last English Summers, which was superbly written and really evocative, and so I think it's fair to say that we both had pretty high hopes reading this, and certainly I wasn't led down. I was first given it by a friend a couple of years ago, and as much as anything, as well as being revelatory, as you've alluded to in your introduction, it's just an absolute pleasure to read, isn't it?
Well, I think Larwood as a figure is one of those people who everyone has heard of, but very few people get the sense of the depth behind him, really. Mm. He's very much just become a name connected with...
And you suddenly get this sense with Hamilton that he feels a real affection for his subject, and actually a real kind of protection, a sort of fatherly protection for his subject throughout the book. And he spends quite a lot of time describing his early life in a way that's actually very eye-opening, isn't it?
Well, I think there's... If you look at the motives for writing a biography, this is clearly an attempt to kind of rehabilitate Larwood in the view of many, and it requires that passion to do it.
Okay, so just briefly to run through Larwood's life and put it into a bit of context. He grew up being a miner in close to Nottingham. Was a county player for Nottingham, and then of course the moment when he came to fame was when he bowled in Bodyline in the 2003 series.
I think his miner background is the key thing, really, in understanding a huge amount about him, because the idea that you would come from a background of that sort of difficulty and that kind of intense day-on-day labour and come almost straight onto the cricket field. I mean, he literally went within a couple of years from the coal mines to England International. And it does rather put into context the trials and tribulations of the modern cricket player. I mean, for Larwood, cricket was this ultimate escape from this brutal, brutal world of like hardship and poverty. And it gave him a sort of, firstly, a love of the game, because the game was this idyllic escape. But also, it gave him a bloody-minded commitment to it. You know, that he had a strength of character that I guess had been bred through hardship.
I think context is one of the most important words with this book, because what it has at its centre, it has the Bodyline crisis of 1932-33, which, as Hamilton very acutely observes, is still, you know, Bodyline is still the word that will... 70, 80 years on, will still provoke debate among cricket
lovers.
There's
a lovely moment when Larwood is asked, isn't he, what will be in your obituary? And then he says something along the lines of, they'll mention Bodyline.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
That'll be the first
line. And so this is rightly sort of the core of the book, but what he does very poignantly and actually in a way that sheds new light on Bodyline is to surround it with the context of Larwood's life. So he starts off, as you say, in the mines, and he talks very interestingly about Nottinghamshire club life in the 20s when Larwood is coming through. And then after Bodyline, he talks about the way in which, you know, Larwood goes off and he runs a sweet shop in, I think it's Scarborough, and then ultimately goes off very ironically to go and live in Australia afterwards. And what Hamilton is very good at is providing that perspective that runs across the whole of Larwood's life.
I think like so many good cricket books, there are plenty of very enjoyable anecdotes here. And with Larwood, some of the anecdotes about his fast bowling get to the point where he's almost kind of a figure of legend rather than almost person. It's a wonderful story about a Leicestershire fast bowler, Hayden Smith. Larwood bowls to him. He's so fast, he's so rapid that the first one flies past Smith's face. The second ball edges, is caught, but it bounces. So it's a bum ball that bounces, caught by slip. And Smith just walks and refuses to return to the crease when asked. And there are so many of these stories about Larwood. And it reminds you how fun it is to kind of see sportsmen as doing things that are beyond the comprehension of mere mortals.
Yeah.
And Larwood did that. I mean, that was what was so extraordinary. He bowled at a pace with an aggression that meant he was seen as just different and kind of separate to other players of his time.
There's also an interesting, talking of, you know, of their time, there are moments in this book when you realise how different a game cricket was back then. And there is this kind of amateur professional divide that runs throughout the whole book. And you have this cricketing life which is permeated by alcohol, actually. Mm. And there's this story of Larwood when he's bowling these kind of 100 miles an hour balls in the Ashes down under in 1932-33. And what he has for breakfast is a couple of sips of beer and a cigarette.
Mm.
And, you know, we were talking earlier about David Boone. And there's this wonderful, I mean, talking of anecdotes as well, there's this wonderful anecdote of George Gunn, who's batting away, a very famous batsman, and he's batting away and he thinks that it should be lunch, but the umpire decides that they're going to delay it by half an hour. And so he just turns around, lets the ball hit his stumps and say, well, I'm going to take lunch when I want to, and walks off and gets out at that moment. And it's a real... But what's really interesting is it's a pen portrait of a bygone age, but it's not done in a kind of patronising fashion. And actually, we're really caught up in the Larwood story and the drama of it.
You're left quite nostalgic for a time when... I mean, Arthur Carr, Larwood's captain, strongly believed in this idea that you cultivated team spirit off the pitch. You would go drinking as a team, And Carr also believed in this idea that it would be the time when the players would let off steam. You know, if they had grievances, they would let off steam. That, and you feel like everything now is that bit more clinical. It's that bit more sterile, and it does kind of leave you slightly longing for it. What of, you mentioned in passing the fact that he does eventually move to Australia. He did this sweet shop he had prior to moving. Do you think this is ultimately a redemption story? I mean, do you end up feeling like Larwood was someone who found happiness, or is it a tragic story, or is it a story that you feel ends in redemption?
It's difficult to know about the story per se, but I think the important thing is about Larwood's public profile, actually. Because we have all these debates that swirl around about Bodyline, and we actually sort of forget about the protagonist. You know, everyone knows about Douglas Jardine, the kind of very aloof England captain, the very aristocratic England captain, but I think we forget about Larwood as a person. And I think simply by telling Larwood's story as a man from the very beginning, Hamilton provides a really compelling account of something that has become cliche over the last few years.
Well, one thing Hamilton explores really well is this idea of kind of the people who Larwood trusted. And I think it's a good sign of any biography that you identify the people in that person's life who were critical, who were defining. And he actually compares kind of the relationship between Larwood and Carr, and Larwood and his father, and Larwood and Jardine, seeing that there were these key, powerful leaders in his life who he deferred to and who he trusted, and they had a huge influence. And I think it gives you a much better understanding, I think, of Larwood's career, but also of Bodyline in particular, that Bodyline was a story in a lot of ways about the relationship between Larwood and Jardine and the trust between them.
I think from both of our perspectives, this is probably one of the finer books that we've reviewed.
I would struggle to imagine
in our 49 episodes.
You sort of struggle to imagine Duncan Hamilton writing a bad book.
Cricket has long inspired adventures, and for this episode's interview, I spoke to the architect of one of the craziest. It's Ollie Broom, and his book, Cycling to the Ashes, A Cricketing Odyssey from London to Brisbane, has just been published.
I was working in the city for about 6 years up until about 2009, or up until exactly 2009, and just had this nagging feeling that there was more to life, and I wanted to escape London and go off and go on a long journey, and decided that 2009 was the right time to do it. Had no girlfriend, like I say, wasn't particularly enjoying my job, and really fancied going and having a look at the Ashes down in Australia, and finding a little bit about cricket and all the countries I travelled through on my way.
Because that's what I was wondering when I was reading all about it, was whether it was something that was motivated by cricket, or whether it was something that was motivated by sort of having an adventure, as it were. And it sounds as if it's sort of a bit of both, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is a bit of both. I mean, it's funny because cricket motivated me on the journey, but it didn't motivate me to want to set off in the first place. So it was a fantastic find, if you like, figuring out that actually cricket was going to be my best motivator, a great tool of motivation along the way. But the way it first developed as an idea was not as a cricket concept. It was more of a travel heading off from London and escaping the city and going off and having an adventure. And it just so happened that I felt like I needed something to cycle towards. I didn't want to just head off and go into the back of beyond and then disappear for a few years and come back and not really have much to show for it, not be able to have something to motivate me. And so I decided to cycle to the greatest sporting event there is, the Ashes.
Best to aim high. And you say that you had something to aim for, as it were. Did you realise how far that, your cycling down to Australia would sort of change your life? Because I think it's fair to say that it has really changed your life, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, for better, for worse, I suppose. I mean, in a way, I wanted it to change my life. I wanted to get out of the sort of working environment that I was in. I wanted to change career. I wanted to go and have an adventure, and I fancied that sort of thing. So, yeah, in a way, I wanted a little bit of change, but it wasn't like I was deeply unhappy it wasn't that important. But, yeah, it's changed my life, and I now earn nowhere near what I was earning before. which is a shame, but I am much happier in what I do for work, certainly. And I've been, you know, off the back of my cycling travels, I then disappeared off to Central Africa to go and build a cricket ground. So that was pretty exciting as well.
Yeah, I was fascinated to read about the about your work in Rwanda. Can you, I mean, it seems like it's kind of improbable story in a sense, this kind of country with absolutely no cricketing background whatsoever, and they've got, you know, David Cameron, Jonathan Agnew and yourself on side to back it, as it were. What caught your eye about it? Where did you see the potential there?
I'm not sure I belong in the same category as David Cameron and Jonathan Agnew, but that's very kind of you.
Well, your name's on the president's board or whatever it is alongside them, so there you go.
Well, it's changed a lot since 1994, so it does have infrastructure. You're right, it doesn't have a lot of cricketing infrastructure in terms of facilities, but what it does have is loads of people who play, and that's the most important thing, I guess, for any developing sporting nation, as you know, cricket nation as well, is people to play and people who keen to play. And you know, lots of people ask me, why are you taking a British sport to Africa? You know, why are you taking a British sport to a country like Rwanda? And my answer is that I wasn't taking it there at all, or we're not taking it there at all. It's Rwandans who brought cricket to Rwanda, because loads of Rwandans who've been in exile since the 60s, when there was another genocide, they grew up in countries like Kenya, Tanzania. They grew up playing cricket, so in those countries. And when they came back to Rwanda in 94, 95, after the genocide, they came back as cricketers and they found no cricket, so they decided to start cricket. So the Rwanda Cricket Association was born basically out of Rwandans returning to their country after the genocide and wanting to play the game they grew up playing abroad. So what they don't have is facilities. So they don't have the resources to build nice grounds. And that's obviously how you improve. And they've improved enormously over the last 18 years, but they could improve even.
And what exactly were you doing when you were out there?
So my role in Rwanda was threefold. It was to raise funds for the charity, to find land for the cricket facilities, and then to build a ground. I mean, I only actually worked the first two of those because the fundraising went well. We raised about £350,000. We still need about £200,000 more, but the project will begin anyway. Phase two or job two was finding land, and that was the bit that took a long time. But we should own land, touch wood, within a month. We found a fantastic plot of 4.5 hectares on the outskirts of the capital, Kigali.
And people can get involved by giving directly to it, can't they? I see you've got some sponsors in the form of some cricket clubs who have given towards it and things, haven't you?
Yeah, Barnes Cricket Club have been fantastic. We've raised loads of money through various events. We had a world record for the longest individual cricket net.
How long was that?
26 hours it was.
Right, okay.
By Albie Shale, but the minister came down and had a bowl. We had Aggers came down, Ravi Bopara came along, and so that was, yeah, people can give. It's the charity is called the Rwanda Cricket Stadium Foundation, and people can give or get involved, volunteer. There'll be loads of volunteering, or even get in touch and see about a game out there, because you know the Rwandans need opposition. It's not easy for them to travel, so they need people to come to Rwanda. The MPC are actually coming down and having a game against Rwanda in Uganda in a few months' time. So,
and that's presumably why they need the ground there, so that players will come from outside Rwanda and come in, which presumably they can't really do at the moment if there aren't the grounds there to play.
Yeah, so one of the big reasons for building this ground, you're completely right, is to encourage a bit of cricket tourism to come, because at the moment there's this one ground and it's terrible, and the MCC got in touch earlier in the year, said, can we come down for a game, and they can't, you know, realistically host the MCC in Rwanda at the moment. So this new ground will enable them to do things like that, and with people visiting, you know, there will be improvement.
Now Ollie, tell me a bit about your book, which has just come out. What did you know that you were going to be writing a book when you set off on your year-long cycle down to Australia?
No, I didn't know at all, actually. And it was pretty quickly, though, that I realised I quite liked writing. You know, I used to enjoy taking a day off and spending a day writing a blog or two, playing around on the internet. So I quite enjoyed that. And I got encouragement as well from friends and people who are following it saying, oh, you're enjoying this storytelling. It's obvious, you know, because you're writing well about it. And that encouraged me. So I kept a detailed diary and I kept loads of voice recordings on a dictaphone. And then sort of kept an eye out for people who might be interested in publishing the book. But it was fairly hard work when I got back and eventually managed to get a book deal. And that obviously put the pressure. I had to get some decent words down, but I've enjoyed the whole process and it's been great. It's been out for about a month now.
I have to confess, I haven't yet read it, but we are going to be reviewing it on Reverse Web Radio later in the summer. But actually, some of the stuff that I have seen, which are some of the films that you've made on your journey, I thought were brilliant at kind of portraying the. Actually, if you don't mind my saying so, the kind of sheer stupidity of the whole exercise of deciding to cycle across the world to watch a game of cricket.
I enjoyed filming it as well, actually. It was good fun. And it was like having a friend, really. You know, when I was carrying a video camera in the middle of Turkey or Sudan or Australia and there was no one else around, I used to talk to the camera. And it was like having a mate, which is weird.
Interesting. One last quick question. Okay, so look into your crystal ball. We're in 10 years' time, and we're looking back on this summer, the summer of 2013. What one thing that either has happened so far or is still to come do you think we'll remember this summer for?
This summer. Mm. That is a very good question.
Presumably, it wasn't Monday's rather drab ending to the.
No, definitely wasn't. I think. It will probably be known as Ian Bell's Ashes, this one. So I think we'll look back on it as the summer when Ian Bell fulfilled his true potential. That's not one moment, so slightly cheating, but I think Ian Bell's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed watching him this summer. And I like to think it's the start of a decent run for him. If it's not remembered for that, possibly be remembered for what a tosser David Warner is.
And finally, to the debate. And this episode, we're asking if cricket is best appreciated by the neutral.
I've watched a fair few games as a neutral in cricket. And actually, I find that when you watch something as a partisan supporter, when you watch England on the last day of an Ashes test in Edgbaston in 2005, you actually have a thwarted sense of perspective that actually means that you don't appreciate the great things that are going on. So, for instance, I'll give you an example. In the last World Cup, India playing Sri Lanka, and the Dhoni innings, I reckon I wouldn't have appreciated if I had been actually either an India or a Sri Lankan fan, simply because you're so hell-bent on a particular goal, the nuances of the game kind of pass you by.
I think firstly, it's important to differentiate between different types of fans. There is the genuinely partisan fan who frankly is an absolute bore, who will see, you know,
and they're often the ones who are stereotyped as kind of football fans.
Right, and who are incredibly frustrating. So a good example will be they will see one of their batsmen eke their way to a miserable, you know, 50, a real,
and
talk about how brilliantly they played, right? And those fans, I think we can all agree, are intolerable people, and that's you know, bad.
Well, you've wiped yourself out of this.
But
out of this debate,
the point is, there are lots and lots of fans who are able to balance, and I think cricket actually stands out in this regard as a sport. There are lots of fans who are able to balance passion for the game with passion for their team. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's one of the few sports, for example, where, say, Michael Clarke's 100 at Old Trafford received support and applause from the England fans. And we as cricket fans are very good at actually appreciating excellence on both sides. And I think it's something very, very admirable.
But I think you're more able to appreciate that excellence if you can actually take moments in and of themselves within the context and appreciate them as that. So, you know, if you see a beautiful cover, say for instance, I was watching the fifth day of the second test in 2006 Ashes, the other day, which is the Ashes, which is a test at, I think, Adelaide, where Collingwood made his 200. England started the fifth day. They were way ahead. They should have won it. And anyway, they ended up completely ballsing it up and losing on the fifth day. And actually, it kind of leaves that bitter feeling in the mouth, that you aren't able to then.
But you see,
take moments in isolation, and I think that's the important thing. That you're not able to actually savour the beauty of particular moments.
I would agree that there's a bitterness, but I would argue that as a partisan, oh no, let's stop using that word. As a fan, you've accessed
no, it is
a
partisan
whole
because
load.
You're taking one side or the other,
right? But you've accessed a whole load of experience that a neutral can't touch. Let's go with that example. I remember up early in the morning listening to that game on TMS, and I remember literally feeling pain in my stomach. I literally remember it being painful. England had been in a position where, what frankly many people thought they could have won the game, but certainly the game was unlosable, and then Warne bowled this spell and they were all hopeless, and Collingwood was still scrapping away in that second innings, desperately trying to hold things together. I remember listening to it thinking, you know, God, if we go 2-0 down, this is it. You know, there's no way you're coming back from 2-0 down.
I agree.
And that,
I mean,
that kind of almost hide behind the sofa agony, that's an experience, you know. That's something that the neutral can't touch.
I think, sir, I agree with you. I love the experience of watching games when you know you're supporting one side or the other, and you're you know, you're really, and you're emotionally involved in that. But I also really enjoy watching. Obviously, I'm an England fan. You might have kind of told that from my language and my accent. But I also enjoy watching games that don't involve England, because actually within those you sort of create your own heroes. And there are games in which you watch people. I remember watching I can't remember who it was against. It was when India were in South Africa, and AB de Villiers, who batted incredibly well, kind of against all the odds in a sense, and his team weren't doing particularly well. And he sort of became a hero, and it enables you to create those own subplots within the game that aren't overshadowed by, you know, decades of hurt as we as England fans have. In the Ashes.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that, I mean, it's one of the reasons I particularly enjoy county cricket. I watch a lot of county cricket games where I have no strong affiliation.
Yeah.
And it's a pleasure to watch the game actually very analytically, you know, to see how good is that bowler,
doing? But as well as being analytical, I think you also do build up affections based on what people are doing in that game, rather than based on a preconceived loyalty to a team.
But I still think...
So even if England behave like complete idiots in a match, as they occasionally do, and even if I completely disapprove and I'm kind of consciously disapprove of what they're doing, I still want them to win.
But let's go back to 2005. I mean, so many cricket conversations.
Everything
go
goes back
to 2005,
doesn't it?
And that national euphoria, it was being a fan that made you able to be part of that. You know, what happened at Edgbaston, this incredible sense of a nation like rediscovering a sport that it had kind of fallen out of love with, and being like, God, what, we can compete with these guys, we can beat this. And that was what it was to be a fan. It was to be part of that shared euphoria.
Compare that, for instance, to a Wimbledon final between Federer and Nadal. That got the nation interested in tennis.
People
took sides there, and people took sides based on the characters of the people who were taking part, rather than any preconceived loyalty. I mean, I can't imagine anyone really has loyalty to Switzerland. It's not really a place one has loyalty to in general. I'd imagine sorry to any of our listeners who are Swiss. It's a wonderful place. I occasionally go skiing there, and it's, you know, it does well, but.
I feel like when you're a neutral, you have the ability to be detached, and there is a lot about being detached that allows you to see things in the game that you wouldn't see otherwise. I mean, if you're following a nervous England chase, for example, you're not going to appreciate some of the nuances.
You still
the
get
placing
nervous
of the
watching.
Field.
You still get nervous watching a chase in which it's two sides who you don't have any interest in. You still get that sense of excitement with it.
No,
I agree, it's not the same sense of excitement, but it's still a sense of excitement.
But I also think the other thing about support is it does involve a real attachment to the team. And I mean, I think the England team's trials and tribulations are something that actually are connected to the mood of a lot of England fans. You know, you feel great when they do well. You feel irritated when they don't. And that part of it is part of what engaging with sport is. It's about sacrificing almost part of your personality to this group of individuals who you'll never know.
I remember an analysis of, actually going back to tennis, I remember an analysis of tennis that said, it's no wonder that tennis is so popular when you have such wonderful contests as you do when you have Djokovic, Federer, Nadal, Murray, great players all playing together. And actually, it's the beauty of engaging in sport and engaging in the contest of sport that gets people interested. But I think what we'll probably both agree is that it's the beauty of engaging in sport as a neutral, but also the beauty of being able to pin one's hopes on a particular side. Anyway, so there we go. That's the 49th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. We're on to our 50th next episode, would you believe it? Hope you've enjoyed this one. You can find us over on Twitter at Reverse Rep, and we look forward to speaking to you soon.